Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of the HLIT podcast. My name is Grace Kim. I'm a 3L at Harvard Law School, and I'm your host. Thank you for joining us, and before we begin, I'd like to give a big shout-out to our sponsor, Cooley, for generously making this season possible. On today's episode, AI Ventures, Navigating Legal Frontiers, we talk to Rebecca Lin, co-founder and general partner of Canvas Ventures, an early growth fund focusing on AI applications in fintech and health tech. Rebecca, a seasoned investor who has earned her place on the prestigious Midas list an impressive 5 times, delves into her wealth of experience navigating the dynamic landscape of venture capital. Learn more about what investing in one of the hottest spaces is like and the considerations that go into identifying and growing successful AI companies. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a few seconds to give us a 5-star rating on your favorite podcast app and to stay up to date on the latest episodes. Hi, Rebecca, and welcome to the HLIT podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here today.
Rebecca, can we start by having you give us a brief introduction about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, I'm a founder and partner at Canvas Ventures, and we invest in early stage companies, mostly in financial services and healthcare. And early stage really means sort of late A, early series B companies. And those companies typically have a product so that we can talk to their consumers. And we've been, you know, it's been a really fun run. I've been doing this for about 16 years. And we've had a number of IPOs and M&As, most recently the Casetext M&A, which is why I think I'm here today.
Yes. And we're so excited to hear more about that. But before we do, let's hear a bit more about your journey. You went to college for a chemical engineering degree, then Berkeley for your JD MBA, really checking all the boxes there. How did you get here doing what you do? And what were the major checkpoints along the way?
I think venture capital is a career where there really is not a linear path. You know, anyone you talk to will probably have a very different story in terms of how they got there. But I was a chemical engineer. I was actually a first-gen college kid. And so I went to the University of Missouri and did chemical engineering and worked at a nuclear research reactor and put myself through school. I had 3 jobs working while I was in school. I worked at the nuclear research reactor. I actually got a patent on radio nuclide generator system when I was there. And then I waited tables. And probably the most exciting job I had is I taught football players chemistry, which was hilarious. So I was a chemistry tutor. Lots of stories there. So I did that. And then I came out of school and worked at Procter & Gamble. I worked in their international department out of Cincinnati. So when I was there, I learned how to launch new products in new markets, and that really has informed a lot of what I do today. And then I left P&G to come out to Silicon Valley for the .com, so just to date myself perhaps a little bit, and worked as the first product person at the credit card company called NextCard. We were actually the first online credit card company, and we had the patent for real-time approval of credit online. So we were really the first company to tap into Equifax and Experian and First Data and all the processors. And so that gave me a lot of knowledge, just how the whole back end works. And so I got to see everything from online marketing, which I ended up, you know, running a piece of that, through to operations, collections, and risk. So I got that full sort of gamut of experience. Actually got my first legal experience then too, because back then, there really weren't standardized contracts for advertising online. So they put me in an office with an attorney and said, here, go, right? And so I learned how to write, and we had deals with probably 3,000 different companies. And so I learned how, you know, the nuts and bolts of contracts when I was there and partnership agreements. And so that was probably the best legal training I ever got was there. And then from there, the company went public. And after that, I started my own company for a number of years. And I actually went back to school on a sabbatical to get a JD MBA at Berkeley. So I worked for about 9 years before I came back.
Obviously, you're able to gain invaluable insights and build skills through all these different positions. But I'm especially curious on what you feel you learned while tutoring football players that you find benefits you in your role today.
You know, I don't ever underestimate anyone. I think that was one. You know, I think incredibly smart athletes that were on their way to med school, actually, that I was able to work with. And the other thing is I learned how, because, I mean, they have limited time. They, you know, they have a super busy schedule with training and traveling and playing and all that. And so I learned how to consolidate information very succinctly and in simple format. So really helping like somewhat complex issues or subjects become pretty easy. And what I learned too is it's all framing. If you tell people something's really easy, they believe it. And so it's all about that preface that this is actually super easy. Just do this. And suddenly it takes on a different level.
And it sounds as if you got a wealth of both business side experience as well as legal side. And then you went to pursue your JD MBA. Did you go in thinking you would do both?
Yeah, I did not actually. What I thought I was going to do was start a patent company, right? So we were going to do a company with sort of this patent pooling and licensing idea. So I actually took the patent bar before school. I had some time to before school started. So what happened is I took the LSAT and did far better than I thought I would on the LSAT. And so when that happened, you know, I said, okay, well, I'm just going to Berkeley. It's got the top, you know, IP school in the country. And it was next door. And so I had some time. So I went ahead and I took the patent bar and then was starting to work on a company in law school and really thought that was the direction I was going to head. I actually also had a baby 2 days after my last final, my second year of law school, which is another kind of funny story. Yeah, what happened was that I thought law school and people would go back and they would really want to start companies. That was my thought when I went in. And when I got there, I found out that wasn't really the case. And so I was sort of by myself, you know, wanting to start a company and thought it would be really interesting to learn finance, which is one area I hadn't really covered in the past. And so I applied to do the joint program at Berkeley. And so I got accepted into the joint program. So I really tacked that on after I was already in school. And it also allowed me to spend sort of one more year in school with my daughter, which was great as well. And I had the opportunity to really see a lot more of the campus and work with different schools.
Yeah. And interestingly enough, I feel like lawyers and investors can be seen at the opposite ends of the spectrum when it comes to risk. How do you judge risk and how risk averse are you personally? And do you feel as if it's changed over time?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's an interesting question. So we take all these personality profiles kind of over time. And what they came back, they told me I was an even 50-50 split, like 50% of decisions I make are on, you know, data numbers and 50% are on gut and intuition. And I actually think the best lawyers also have an intuition and gut about them and they can read people, you know, pretty well. And so I think for me, you know, I probably have always been on more on the willing to take risk, but very calculated risk, right? So moving, you know, leaving my job, moving to the Bay Area without a job, like that was a risk, but, or, you know, taking risk on companies, but they're informed risk, right? And I like strategy games. I love playing poker, right? I grew up playing poker with my dad, from the time I was probably 4 or 5 years old. And so, that's something that I really like. And I think, you know, I get really bored if it's the same thing all the time, right? So I think for me, you know, when I would launch a new product, I love the part about building and, you know, getting rid of the bugs and launching the product and signing the deals and growing it. But then I wanted to move on. I wanted to go and do the next thing. And so the really nice thing about venture in particular is I get to see so many different companies and I get to come in and like fix things at different stages of the company when they need my help. And that's what I really enjoy doing. And even back at school, when I was at the nuclear reactor, I mean, that was the largest, it's the highest powered nuclear research reactor in the country, which meant we got all the super cool research, right? We got the space crystals and the O-rings and the astronauts would come in from time to time. And so I loved just walking into all the different labs that were there and seeing all these different things that they were doing. It was really interesting to me. So I think on the risk side, I don't know if I've adjusted over time, but I'm more comfortable in uncertainty and chaos than I am in certainty.
And as such, you are now the co-founder of Canvas Ventures. Starting from the beginning, what was your inspiration? I know it was a spinoff, but what led you to take that step?
An interesting question. So I started at Morgan Thaler Ventures, which was a fabulous, you know, venture capital firm that had been around for about 45 years, right? And I started in their fund, the last fund that we invested, That fund was really a new strategy and a departure from what they had done in past funds. And so in that, and the fund that I started in, we really focused on these companies that we called at the inflection point, right? Where we felt like they had some semblance of product market fit, but they really needed help on that growth trajectory. And we focused on really lightweight models like software services, things like that. And so that was an incredibly successful fund. That fund had Doximity and Lending Club and Check, all were in that fund. Evernote was in that fund. And so when we decided to raise the next fund, we had a choice. Do you, you know, start with a new brand or do you continue with the brand you have? And I actually had done this when I was at Procter & Gamble, right? That was always, that was a question. We bought a company and do we keep the brand or do we change the brand? And so there were a lot of reasons to change it. And really, probably the biggest reason was that we wanted to grow the firm over time. And so we wanted to add people that would feel ownership. And it's quite hard to do that when somebody else's name is on the door, right? And you've seen this across the board at other venture capital funds. They shorten it to an abbreviation or something like, right? So, and it's tough. I think law firms suffer this too oftentimes, right? It's people want, you know, ownership. And so it's hard to do that if there's somebody else's name. We also had the compounding issue with the name wasn't spelt like everyone thought they should spell it. So people would misspell it all the time. That's kind of rule one in branding, have a brand you can spell. And then we also wanted just to basically build the firm and have a clean canvas, ironically, to make it the kind of firm we would want to work with as entrepreneurs.
Do you feel as if any of those goals have changed over time?
I don't think the goals have changed over time. I think my bar keeps going up and up. And so, you know, in terms of my goals for myself, I mean, I'd like to be the top on the Midas list at some point in time, right? So we'll see what happens there. But I think the sectors that we're interested in definitely shift over time, right? So that does change, and the investing theses change over time. But all of them are informed by what we've seen in the past.
Rebecca, you've never been one to shy away from this industry. You mentioned Lending Club, which ended up being one of the largest U.S. technology IPOs of 2014 and the fourth largest U.S. internet IPO behind Facebook, Twitter, and Google. What are you looking for when deciding to invest?
So what do I look for? So I look to invest in companies that if I wasn't doing venture, I would think I would either want to start them or join them. Right. Because we're in the company for quite a long time. We're in the company, you know, on average, I think it's 10 years, right? Lending Club wasn't that long. Lending Club, we did in 2009 and it went public in 2014. So that's actually pretty fast, right? And so, you know, I really look for opportunities that have kind of a why now component, you know, so they're a great idea, but why is now the time that this should happen? And Lending Club was exactly that. Lending Club was, you know, Lehman crash in 2008. We did that in Q1 of 2009, right? And the banks were shut down. And the investment memo said, you know, banks will be frozen for 3 to 5 years. So we had that much runway ahead of us to really build a brand and grab consumers. The same thing with Doximity. You know, why now, right? And it was this sort of, you know, with mobile and with social and with all that, and doctors didn't have sort of this network, right, that we thought they needed, and it hadn't been done in the right way. And that particular founder had started a successful company in the past, right? So it with Hippocrates. So that was very interesting. And Case Text, I mean, why now? That was probably the biggest why now. I mean, I went through law school just completely confused why on earth, you know, there was a $6 billion industry built on essentially free data that was public, right? And, you know, and that you had to construct searches with, you know, I want cat within, you know, three sentences of dog in the same paragraph is like whatever, you know? And that just, it was amazing that was just how bad it was and that how much money they were making. And that lawyers would just do the same work over and over and over again. And that, you know, that to me, it just made no sense. And that it was time to change that. And so, you know, the team there was just incredible. You know, Pablo is the CTO there. He was Berkeley and then Stanford Law. And then, you know, Jake, the CEO, just had actually programmed most of his life before he went to law school. And so just a really amazing team. And then Laura as well. I mean, you have her you know, she was a graduate from Yale, and she was a phenomenal co-founder and CEO as well. So that was a big kind of why now. So I really look for why now, and I look for founders who have resilience. I will spend a lot of time chit-chatting, is what it seems like, I think, to people with founder to understand, you know, what's driving them, and to understand if they have, you know, if they have stories in their past that lead me to believe that when everything looks really super dark, because it will at many times in a startup, and Case Tech definitely had those trials and tribulations, that they will sort of get up and dust themselves off and make it through. And so that's something that oftentimes is missing. And if there's missing, I won't do it.
You mentioned resilience. What instances of that did you see when working with the Case Tech team?
Well, I mean, just having been an attorney, right? I wanted to be able to use that product that they wanted to build, right? And it was funny when I first saw them. They had no. It was in their seed round. They had no revenue. I think they were a YC company, and they had a very different strategy, right? They're very different. It was more crowdsourcing kind of stuff, and then even in the A, it was quite different, right? And so I watched them go through the process, and good companies and good founders will do that. They'll start with an idea and they kind of pivot as they listen to their customers. And companies that don't work don't listen to the customer. They just keep on their idea, right? And Jake and Laura and Pablo actually did a really good job listening to their customers and then being at like the absolute bleeding edge of what was possible with large language models. And they were always at the forefront. And we had been, you know, we've been in AI for, you know, well over a decade. We did Siri when I was at Morgan Thaler, Figure Eight, which was really picks and shovels for machine learning and AI. That company sold to a public company called Appen. And then we did Luminar, which is a public company now, right? And that company is involved in autonomous driving. So very deep, you know, AI and machine learning, and then Case Text. And so we had seen it for a while, but, you know, the really interesting thing was that, you know, they kept at the front edge of LLMs, but it just wasn't good enough. And so they had tried to pass the California state bar in, I think, March of 22, like 22 timeframe, right? And it wouldn't pass the bar. It scored maybe, I think, 30-ish percent, you know, give or take. And then in July of 22, I got a call from Jake, and he's like, you know, that product roadmap we showed you, we're going to put that all completely aside. We just saw what was GPT-4, right? And so he made the decision as a CEO to basically stop everything that they were doing at that point in time and focus it on the product that they could build using GPT-4. And then in January of 23, they had the product. And it still had some rough edges, but they were pretty ready to go. It blew me away. It was absolutely phenomenal in terms of what it could do. And what they actually proved it could do is it could do better than the average California bar pass rate. So I think it scored in the 90 percentile range, where the bar pass rate, I think, is like 68, 69%, right? So it was really amazing just the step up that it made. And the point to that, too, is that had they not been in process before that hit, had they not had momentum and steerage kind of, and customers and use cases and data that they could tap into, they would not have been positioned to take advantage of that so quickly. And so they were at the forefront the entire time, and then were able to really take advantage of that, of the GPT-4 and the advances in AI and machine learning as soon as it hit.
And Pablo spoke a little bit as to how viewing GPT-4 completely changed the trajectory of their company. Tech, especially AI, is changing constantly. How is investing in AI different from other tech companies or other emerging companies in general?
Yeah, I think, I mean, AI is a technology. So we really look at companies in a very verticalized focus, right? So we don't go out and say, hey, we want to find an AI company or any tech or a cloud company or a mobile company or I don't even know what you call the Neuralink technology, but I'm really interested in that. But we don't do that. And so what AI has done is enable some developments in these verticals that weren't possible before. So, you know, companies like Case Text and many others that can now jump ahead and then fulfill the promise that they set out to deliver, right? So, and legal tech is tough, I will say. You know, we looked and looked and looked for the right company in legal tech. We believe, and so And then we followed Case Techs for a while, and we led their Series B, right, when we felt like they had the traction and we shared the same thesis for what they were going to accomplish. But I think legal tech in general is tough, and a lot of what is so hard about it is the go to market. And so you've got this really kind of fragmented market. You've got some big, huge enterprise firms, and then you have, you know, lots of firms in this mid market, and then you have these little, you know, onesies, twosies, right? And so it's a hard market to sell into, and it's a very hard market to scale. I think it's not a market either, I believe, that can have, you know, multiple winners. And so you really have to be careful and pick the right one.
Are there regulations or changes in the space lawyers may want to be aware of?
You know, I don't have a crystal ball for that. I think, you know, there will be some structure and regulation around AI and the use of AI. You know, sometimes it takes a lot longer than you think it's going to or it should. It took a ridiculously long time and still isn't with crypto, right? I kept thinking, surely, you know, this is going to happen. We have done fintech, you know, for, I don't know, 20-ish years almost. And, you know, to me, it was very clear that, you know, that it was a security. And so, but we're just now seeing that, right? I do think that regulation will come. It has to be very thoughtfully done. And sometimes it just takes a lot longer than we all think it should, right? And so I think what's really important is that people like the executives at Case Techs, for example, are in those discussions so they can be informative in terms of, you know, what they've seen, because they've been there for so long and they've seen how to use things in the right way and what the risks are.
Can you sort of walk us through what the process was for raising the Series B?
Okay, so the process of investing in Case Techs really started at their seed and their A rounds, where we didn't get involved, but we built the relationship. And not only did we build a relationship, we introduced Jake to this man named Yaron, who became his board member later. And the reason Yaron was important is that he had actually built this sort of go-to-market and sales motion for another company that had sold in the legal tech space for you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. And so Yaron had done that in the past. And that was really important. It was important to me that Jake sort of reached out to Yaron, right? Because what you want to see in a founder is you really want to see them surround themselves with people who have more experience than they have and educate themselves. And he did that right away. And then Yaron stayed close to the company. And then a few months later, I got a phone call and he said, hey, they now have, you know, three paying clients. And that was what I was waiting for. I was waiting to see if these big firms would actually pay for the product or not. And so when they got the clients, that's when we came in and I called Jake and said, hey, can we talk about a round? Usually when I'll do a deal, it's not when they're quote in a process, right? And you could argue too that everyone's always fundraising, right? But, you know, if I first encounter a company and they're like, hey, we're on Sand Hill Road, can we be there at noon? We have five other deals. We're just like, no, forget it. Like, that's just not how we do it, because we need that time. And quite frankly, I need to know that the CEO values that time ahead of time too, right? That the CEO is trying to build those relationships, because the more you can get to know each other beforehand, when the time comes to raise the round, it's already sort of an understanding, right? And so, yeah, so we had a discussion and he was open to a Series B, and that's when we came in.
Is this normally how most of your deals get started?
Typically, I mean, there are many different ways that we get introduced, right? And so most of the time, the introductions come from somebody in our network. And so, but we have this informed lens. So the one I just did, one that's not announced, in AI and health tech or digital health. And that one came from a very senior leader at Doximity, who had actually worked with this person for a number of years in prior health startups. So he knew sort of the thesis that I was pursuing in this space. And so when they came in, it was very linear. But most of our deals come to us this way. A lot of them are outbound too. So we'll have a thesis and we'll be looking in a particular space. And oftentimes we will proactively reach out to somebody. And then yes, most of the deals are a series of conversations over time. And so, and even Doximity, I mean, I saw it in the A. It was a very different company in the A than the B. In the A, it was really this kind of messaging app, which I was confused by because doctors don't really talk in real life, right? They don't coordinate. And so if you, people don't like pick up new behaviors, you know, that they don't do kind of offline. And so I never thought that made much sense, right? And so as Doximity was sort of figuring out their way and getting more and more people kind of on the platform, and showing that the network kind of effect that they had, that's when we came in.
When do lawyers step into the process?
So we have a fund counsel. We have a lawyer that helps us, you know, with our, you know, fund issues. So, you know, papering the fund documents, helping to raise the fund, almost acting kind of like bankers in some ways, right? We have attorneys that help us just with the running of our firm, right? So it might be an HR lawyer, it might be a contracts lawyer. And then we have the attorneys that do help us with the actual investing part of this. So the investing part of the raise. And so, you know, it depends. I sometimes play a lawyer on TV still. So I'll often, you know, do the initial term sheet myself. And a lot of partners do, right? Usually the initial term sheet's a pretty simplified document that a lawyer has blessed along the way. And then the lawyers really come in when you're papering it. So once you have a decision, you're going to do the deal. Both parties have signed the term sheet. That is typically then when we'll call a counsel, right? And hopefully our favorite lawyers are available and not conflicted. So the hard part is when you have your favorite, my favorite attorney I like to work with. And if that firm is already on the other side of the deal, then you have to find somebody else, right? Which is sometimes challenging.
What are some other ways that you evaluate the potential of a company before deciding to invest? Are there any specific criteria or indicators, and do those change when we're thinking about legal tech or just tech and AI?
I don't think they change. What the consumer says, right? What the consumer says. Whoever is the end person using that product, I will absolutely talk to a few of those before I make any decision. And that really stems from my training at Procter & Gamble. When I would design products there, it taught a huge amount of humility to all of us because we would think we had the best product and we would put it out there, or we would prefer a design or some kind of feature, and it would fail miserably. And then we just learned to be very open-minded and put lots of things in people's hands, right? And then we learned to listen how they talked about them and not try to write our own script, right, about what they should like. And I think it's kind of a big flaw in Silicon Valley. I often see, I call it engineers going wild, is that, you know, they, you sit around a table and people start using the I word, or my wife or my kid or my, you know, whatever. You know, you're in a very dangerous territory when you start hearing those things, because, you know, Silicon Valley venture capitalists are not the target market for 99.9% of all companies that come in the door, right? They're just not. And so you really have to learn how to listen to what the customer says and doesn't say, and they'll educate you. They'll tell you what they like, what they don't like. And I always ask, I said, you know, what would happen if you didn't have this product tomorrow? What would, and if they say, well, you know, I have this kind of workaround, no big deal, you pass, right? But you listen to, you know, what they're telling you and how important, you know, things are. And then oftentimes too, they'll have ideas or suggestions or guidance in terms of what they'd like to see. And early on, it's never perfect. No customer, you know, will tell you it's perfect, right? But they will talk about, you know, the pain point, the problem addressed. They'll talk about, you know, everything else they tried to do to solve the problem that they had. And then what the product was like to work with.
What were the lessons learned with CaseText?
So I can answer. I mean, Pablo probably talked a lot about this, but, you know, most companies are not up and to the right. You know, they have wiggles along the way. And, you know, and they, a lot of them are consistent, you know, and all throughout many companies. And so one lesson that we seem to have to learn often is not to hire a really expensive enterprise sales team too quickly before you truly have product market fit. And so what often happens, and what happened at CaseText, is we thought, you know, early on we had product market fit. We really did, you know, right, you know, years into the investment. And we hired, you know, a sales team and we scaled it up, and we didn't have product market fit. And it took a little bit to kind of admit that to ourselves, right? And to Jake's credit, Jake spent a lot of time talking to the end users and the consumers and understanding what they really needed, right? To truly replace like Westlaw and LexisNexis, right? Like he spent a lot of time with them to figure that out and spent a lot of time also externally, you know, talking to other businesses and leaders in legal tech. And so that was definitely one sort of, you know, challenge that we had. And so to his credit though, you know, Jake made a decision and it was tough because we really loved our sales team, right? To cut the sales team, save that cash and capital, and then focus back on the product, right? And focus too on the core market that we knew we could serve and do that well. And so that was one, I guess, a trial or tribulation we had in the company.
And I'm sure there are times when you had to work with founders to make tough decisions. Do you have an example of this with Casetext? How are you able to navigate that?
So I think the toughest decision we really ever faced at Casetext was whether or not to sell the company and at what price. And so what happened was the company was doing really well and they were growing year over year. And they had a very, you know, good eye on profitability in a very short period of time, right? Before they launched at CoCounsel, which was the GPT-4 product. And so we had no intention of raising money again or selling. And when they launched that product, the revenue just took off and people, you know, heard a lot about it. And in hindsight, it's kind of funny because we didn't really know what was going to happen, right? Jake was really excited. The team was super excited. But, you know, as a venture capitalist, you learn to be a little cynical, you know, and a little bit more conservative. But I think the scale and the uptake met all of the team's expectations. And so when Thomson Reuters came in, you know, with an offer, it was a good offer. You know, the initial offer was a really good offer, but you know, it wasn't kind of where we wanted it at the time. And I firmly believed if we held, you know, the number could be in the billion plus range, right? However, you really have to take a lot of things into consideration. I mean, there are a few things to think about. You know, one is the team and how long they've been in it for and what an outcome would mean for them. The other thing is how forward priced is it, right? Like what has to happen and how much water is really between here and the next exit date? Because what happens when these new trends come out is there are really two times you can exit, right at the beginning of the trend. And oftentimes that is the highest exit that will ever come, right? And then if you don't exit right at the beginning, you have to show that you can bring in the revenue, right? You have to really prove it out and you have to go through that whole valley of death is what we call it. And then you get to the other side. And then usually that's a sale on revenue, right? And revenue and growth of revenue. And, you know, if you can make it all the way there, that's great. But some companies don't. And like Google and Yahoo and others all have stories about how they, you know, could have sold early and they didn't. And then they were, you know, massive companies. But it doesn't always end that way, right? And so we did decline the first offer that came in. And that was hard. That was really hard, right? Because it's life-changing money for everyone. And it was a very stressful 24 hours, I will tell you. But we were pretty confident that they would come back with a better number. And they did. And then there was still a discussion of do we take that or not? Because the board, we were so excited about potential and what they could do with CoCounsel. But it was a conversation with everyone and with the team. And then also a conversation about like what they could accomplish within a bigger company like Thomson Reuters with a fully big sales force, right? And so that was probably the toughest decision we ever had to face at the company is whether or not to sell.
And in those conversations, who is involved?
Yeah, I mean, the other investors, definitely the other board members, we discussed it with them. And definitely, I mean, the founders and the executive team. And just had to, and they talked to them, we call them the ministers of the interior, right? With their significant others, right? In terms of how they felt. I mean, it's really important. People overlook that all the time. But the person's spouse has a lot of sway, right? And so I was just lucky that Jake's wife was with me on declining the first offer, right? And so, yeah, husbands, wives, you know, you have to make sure that everyone's on board, right? And so those are important. Those are important because what you're talking about are people's lives.
Yeah, and that's not something that we would naturally think of firsthand.
I don't know how many of your classmates are married at this point, but you know, it becomes important and it becomes important too. I mean, you know, Jake had another baby on the way. Laura has a couple kids too. at young children, right? And so, you know, there are definitely like just life considerations that come up in all these situations.
Right. And we've been talking about these founders and now their spouses, but you yourself are an entrepreneur and founder as well. As the co-founder of Canvas Ventures, is there anything that you did not expect to run into? What skills or experiences from your extensive experience do you feel best prepared you to deal with these unexpected roadblocks and to have that resilience that you look for in other founders?
I don't think I came into it with a ton of expectations. I just didn't. It's one of the, you know, I think in life I had, you know, before coming into venture, I had always done sort of the next logical thing, right? You know, grad school, you know, promotions, you know, all of those kinds of things. And venture was really interesting. I mean, I got into venture by luck. I literally ran into my partner, Gary Little, in line for pizza at an event I was hosting at Berkeley. And when he first said, hey, you know, come join us for the summer, I said, no. And so, because at that time, you have to think about the time, this was like 07, 08. There were no women in venture. And I just didn't want to deal with it, to be honest. I had a young kid and I just didn't want to deal with it. And I sort of saw it as like banking or something. And I was an entrepreneur and I'm like, no, my life is too short, right? It was kind of how I saw it. And I had a good friend come to me and be like, are you an idiot? That's the nicest man in venture capital. And it's such a nice firm. And you should go apologize and do this thing. And keep in mind too, I was totally sleep deprived and I had a 3-month-old baby at home, right? And so I came in and really enjoyed it. And it's the first time I think I ever took a job, and not for how much it paid, but for because I just liked it. And I actually made less than what I was at my old company, right? Initially. But I just took that leap because for the first time I felt like, hey, I'm really enjoying this. I would do this even if I weren't paid. I'm just gonna keep going. And then when the Lending Club deal happened, I don't even know what my title was. I didn't negotiate for title. I negotiated to only work half time because I was trying to kind of balance, you know, everything out initially. That's not how it is anymore, or has been for a long time. But I was only working part time. But I just found I really loved it. And so I just found myself working all the time. And it was absolutely not about salary or title or any of that. And then what happened was my plan, I never thought I'd be a venture capitalist, right? I just thought they were kind of being nice to me and letting me kind of learn vicariously through them. And then I was working on a company and on the side, and I would eventually have them fund it. That was my plan coming into this. And then when we gave Renaud the term sheet at Lending Club for the round, Renaud looked at Gary and I and said, well, I'll do this, but only if Rebecca's the board member. And that kind of stopped me cold, right? Because I hadn't expected that. And that really kind of cemented, like that was my path in, right? Because I hadn't, like I said, I hadn't planned it. There's no path in venture capital. There's really not a promotion trajectory. It's very unlike law. I mean, in law, it's like your first year, second year, third year, and so on. That does not exist at all in venture. And so unlike probably most men in venture at the time, Gary said, of course, we'll do that. And then he trained me, which was incredible. A lot of people don't get training in venture, and I got a lot of training. So I didn't come in with a ton of expectations, I don't think. You know, I didn't expect it to be a certain way. I really didn't know. I think I was just shocked that venture capitalists had to raise their own money. I always thought they had to raise money from other institutions, right? I always thought they just kind of invested out of their own pocket. And I didn't know. But we have investors just like startups have investors. And one of the things that's been really kind of interesting to me is that our money comes from like pension funds, so teachers and firemen and police and the sort. And so our work really makes a difference, right, in terms of funding, funding teachers' retirements and things of that nature, which I think is really important. So that was surprising to me, I will say. Yeah, there are a lot of skills, I think, that I learned over time that have helped me in venture. I think that probably the most important skill for at least where I invest in venture, which is very early, there's very little data really to look at yet, is reading people. And so it's always been kind of a skill set that I people would joke with me that I hadn't, right? That I kind of could tell immediately and have a good read on somebody. I don't always get it right. I've gotten it wrong from time to time, but I'm more right than wrong, which is all that. In venture, you just have to be right one more time than you are wrong. So that's how it works. But that skill has really served me well in venture and in hiring and in helping people work through tough situations. I mean, sometimes you just have to help the CEO and the ability to listen to and just say, hey, you got to just land the plane, right? And this is, you know, it's a good thing that you tried to take this risk and you succeeded. Now land the plane and move on, right? And sometimes, you know, just I think being a woman sometimes helps me with that, and the empathy I think helps quite a bit. Not that guys can't be empathetic, but I think I have a little bit of a different role, you know, when I'm having those discussions.
Speaking of being a woman, Rebecca, you became a mother in law school, you juggled three jobs in college, and now you're an incredibly successful investor in a historically male-driven industry.
But you still enjoy riding your horses. And
I know. Utter chaos. I mean, it's my I'm happier when things, there's a lot going on, right? I'm in a better state. I think when I am not as happy is when everything's very steady state and kind of copacetic. But, you know, I think I've always been that kind of person. I've always, you know, been super interested and wanted to see what was out there. And, you know, and I've always worked really hard. And so even when I tried to take a break, yeah, I had that time before law school. And, you know, because when I got into Berkeley and I'm like, oh shoot, now I have, you know, some time to kill. I started a company, right? I just can't sit still. And I've always just been that way. And so, you know, it was a lot. I mean, definitely, with the kids and the company and all that, it's a lot. And, you know, and it's interesting too, but I prioritize my kids all the time. I mean, my oldest daughter's going through college admissions right now and acceptances and figuring out where she's going. And I'm on a plane tonight to take her to go see a school tomorrow where she was admitted and she wants to go take a look at it. And I'm on a plane next week also. And so a lot of the way you make this work is everything folds together. And, you know, I'll have a couple calls, you know, on the way to, you know, to go see a school that I have to take from investors or companies or prospects or whatever. And that just really, I think you just have to fold it together. Like your life can't, it's hard to compartmentalize things. And the more you just kind of make it all work, I think the better it is.
When working with lawyers, what have you found particularly beneficial or supportive?
So I've worked with a lot of different lawyers in my life. I have worked with lawyers when I was at a startup, and I've worked with lawyers for, you know, personal matters, and I've worked with lawyers, you know, at companies, both my counsel and company counsel. And the one thing that I look for is a very business-minded lawyer. And this takes a bit. I mean, I was at Quinn Emanuel during an internship, and I worked with a lot of, you know, Harvard and Stanford trained lawyers. I had worked for about 9 years before going to law school, and I didn't know till the end, but I did like three times more projects than any of the rest of them. And it's because I had worked, and I went in and I would go ask the partner. I wouldn't just sit and start working on the assignment ever. I would go into the person who had asked, made the request, and I would ask what audience it was for. Right. And if they said, oh, I just needed an email with some bullet points, great. Or they just needed research so they could be educated before talking to the client, great. Or this is going to the judge, right? That's a different thing. And what happened with people that hadn't worked and had gone straight through school is they would gold plate everything and like do the, you know, the crazy, like, you know, formatting and everything for the source and all of that. And they didn't care. And so they were trying to get more throughput. And I think lawyers that are good understand the business side. So they'll go and very quickly understand, well, what is the context? How fast do you need this? And does this need to be gold plated or not? Right. And so many people, especially people who have not worked before they go into law school, don't get that. And they think they're going to bother people. And then they spend all this time on things that at the end of the day just don't matter. And so that's one thing. I look for lawyers that are very business minded. And then I have, I try to avoid what I call brick wall lawyers. These are lawyers that are, you know, very smart people, I am sure. And they feel like it's their job to educate me on the law, which I'm always very confused by. And they'll cite, you know, this is the law and this is that. And they just, you know, and I'm like, well, that wasn't my question. My question was how to solve the problem. So your job is to tell me, I don't need you to tell me what the law is. I need you to tell me what the risk is, right? So yes, there might be a rule that you shouldn't do X, but maybe it's a $50 fine, right? And so maybe I just pay the fine and go, right? And then in other cases, maybe there's something small, but it could kill the company and you need to size that for me, right? And so I think people coming out of law school, they get stuck on this, you know, quoting the law thing, and nobody cares. They just care with purpose, right? And they care how to get around it. And so what I'll often say to lawyers is like, I'm telling you I'm doing this. Now tell me the best way, right? And a lot of lawyers just want, they're very proud of themselves for saying no, but the best ones are the ones that are outspoken. So they will keep you out of trouble, right? But they'll also help you figure out how to mitigate your business risk and be compliant, but do it in a way to grow the business. And the other thing too, is when you look at the huge companies that have been built, most of them were in the gray side of the regulation. And some of them were in the red. Like if you look at PayPal, that was clearly not okay for a very long time. If you look at Coinbase, of course it's a security, right? Lending Club, of course that's a security. You know, Uber, Airbnb, Skype. I mean, these companies were all, now we can look back and say, oh, it was gray. It was pretty bright, screaming red at that point in time. And the thing is sometimes you look at it and you're like, hey, is it worth taking the risk? We know what the law is, right? And then let's work to change the law, right? Because a lot of the laws that are there on the wrong side of are things that maybe made sense, you know, 20 years ago, but don't make sense now. And so then you have to really think about it. And one of the things that the companies that make it versus the ones that don't, the ones that can sort of skate on the regulation kind of razor, let's say, are the ones that work collaboratively with the regulators. So the thing that these companies do that is good is they confront it head on. They talk to the regulators. They typically don't upset them. I mean, there are, of course, a couple of examples of people who have largely upset the regulators that still worked out. But the better thing I have seen over time is to work as much as you can in collaboration with the regulators and then you know, communicate with them as much as you can.
So in keeping with our theme on startups and founders, every entrepreneur experiences highs and lows. I'd love to hear about some of those in your journey. What have you been the most proud of, and what have you learned about yourself throughout this process?
Most proud of? I mean, I'm so proud of the culture and the firm we've built here and the success, you know, just the success of every one of the companies. I don't think there's one company that I've been more proud of than others. I was also really proud. We at Canvas, we just look for, I mean, our job is to make our investors money, right? And that is our job, returns, right? And we never really had a mandate to back women or minority. We just, minorities or anything like that. We just thought our mandate was good returns. And it was kind of interesting. You know, people were starting to talk about it a few years ago. And I kind of thought, well, we back a lot of women in our companies, but we don't talk about it. And when we went out and pulled the numbers, we had like well over 30%, you know, of our, you know, have women founders or CEOs, right? So, and co-founders, like Laura is prime example at Case Text, right? But, you know, I was really proud of that because, again, it was not a mandate. We didn't go out to do it. But it's just some of our most successful companies. I mean, Doximity, Sherry Buck is the best product person I've ever met, right? And she led engineering there and had a phenomenal group of female data scientists that were in Doximity. So, you know, we didn't set out to do it, but I was really proud of the fact that it kind of happened vicariously because of our own selection. You know, I think the one lesson that I learned is that sometimes investing in founders that are just product, and it is hard because they don't understand the go-to-market challenge necessarily. And they think if I just do one more feature, it'll sell itself. And, you know, and so I sort of joke that they've never met a go-to-market challenge a feature wouldn't fix, right? And that doesn't work. And so I like founders that have a good product sense, but also that really understand and have an appreciation of how to sell it and how to go to market and scale. And that's hard to have both, but I like founders that have both and that actually really keep a focus on the go-to-market and can kind of have somebody else really on the product front more and more. But it's a very hard thing to do both. I mean, Jake did a great job of doing both of those things, I would say, at Case Text, but it's tough. That's a tough thing.
And we've come up on time. Rebecca, thank you for joining me today on the HLab podcast.
Thank you for your time. I'm honored. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to season 3 of the HLab podcast, proudly brought to you by Cooley. We'd like to thank our sound engineer, Nick Besso, and of course, Rebecca, for sharing her time and insights with us. Join us next time to learn more about emerging industries. And as always, if you enjoyed this episode, please give us a 5-star rating. The HLab podcast is a production of the Harvard Law Entrepreneurship Project, an officially recognized Harvard Law School student organization. The views and opinions expressed in the podcast are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect the official position or policy of Harvard Law School or Harvard University.